and welcome to our Health and Wellness Podcast. I'm Mayan Hoffman, Head of Strategy and Senior Health Analyst, and I have with me
Rosella Tercatin, Health Reporter and Archaeology Reporter at the Jerusalem Post.
So we're very excited to be here during our first edition of this Health and Wellness Podcast. It's part of our initiative to bring more health and wellness information and news to our readers. We have a new portal on jpost.com that we hope you'll check out. And today we're going to talk about a lot of things health and wellness, starting with COVID. So the Delta variant's going down, right, Rosella?
Apparently it is, Mayan, and it is very exciting, even though we have to be cautious. We are seeing trends that are definitely encouraging. First and foremost, number of serious patients is finally going down, and the trend seems to be pretty steady. Experts agree that this is an encouraging sign all across the board. We're also seeing a general reduction in number of cases, in the R reproduction rate that expresses where morbidity is at.
Meaning how many people one sick person is going to infect.
Exactly. We have to say that we are just out of a month of holidays, so number of tests performed every day have fluctuated. People have not been in school or at work, but experts seem to believe that this is not just by chance. The numbers are really going down.
So that's really exciting. I mean, I think we are holding at more than 700 serious patients. Now we're holding closer to around 500 with the trajectory that we're going to continue to see this going down. You know, I think what's interesting here is that we can do a little bit of analysis on how the government is handling it. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was just at the UN last week. We know what happened there. There was a whole blow up with him putting down the doctors and taking credit for our COVID efforts. But in the end of the day, it seems that the policy is slowly but surely starting to work. The combination of the third booster and the Green Pass program, which is just got more strict yesterday. But, you know, what's also been interesting is to watch how Bennett has been very careful. Yesterday, he sent out some remarks and he said not to become complacent. Then the cabinet, in the end, the coronavirus cabinet met recently, you know, and they said we're not yet ready to vote on new reduction of rules. With the idea that we have to monitor and be careful. And, you know, I think, let's be honest, right, we've seen this before. The difference was that in the summer, in the spring, summer, when the cases started going down, we got a message of go out and party. Israel has made it. And now we're getting a message of, well, we maybe made it for now. There will probably be another variant coming in. I mean, do you agree with that? Do you think we're done, or is there going to be something else?
Listen, a variant we know can always come up. We know that Israel has relied heavily on vaccination as a strategy to keep morbidity down. So far, when vaccination has been effective, it has worked. On the other hand, we don't know the long-term protection vaccination offers us.
And this last one just lasted 4 months.
Exactly. So we'll have to see. Some experts suggest maybe the correct way of administering the Pfizer vaccine is just 3 shots, and that's what we needed. But there's also people who will say that one of the reasons why these RNA vaccines are so safe is because the material, the substance, deteriorates quickly in the body, not leaving an effect. And so it can be that also the protection that it guarantees, it's only good for a few months.
Which could be very scary, because in that aspect, we'd be vaccinating every 4 to 6 months, you know, probably here in this country and everybody else, everywhere else abroad, which is not only going to be a lot of, you know, requirement for people to come and show up, which might not happen, but also this idea that it would be very expensive for the country. So hopefully there'll be a solution. You know, there are a couple of solutions I feel like that we've been talking about recently. One of them, of course, if we're talking vaccines, is the Israeli vaccine. Israel is working on this vaccine called BreLife. Back in the summer, and I think it was July, we signed a contract with NRX, an American pharmaceutical company, and we're fast-tracking our Phase 2 and Phase 2B trials with the idea that in the next few months, maybe by January, we'll be in Phase 3. You know, I recently spoke to Professor Shmuel Shapira, who was the head of the Israel Biological Institute during the time of most of this development. We had thought in Israel that we would have a vaccine right away. I mean, we were on par with Pfizer, Moderna. It was like the startup nation miracle, you know, that we like to see out of Israel. And then all of a sudden, there were a lot of bureaucratic delays. But in speaking to the professors that are working on it, it looks like our BreLife vaccine, which is a different kind of vaccine, it's a vector vaccine, is going to be effective. Whether it will confer longer-term effects than Pfizer, we don't know. But if it works, Israel is guaranteed to have some of those. So that's at least exciting news for us.
Vaccination autonomy, we know, is very, very important.
For sure. Now, but there are things we're doing now beyond vaccines also. You're talking about Regeneron lately.
Yes. So recently, Israel has started to offer Regeneron to patients who are mild to moderate, so not serious COVID patients. They're still at home. But according to what medical professionals know, they are at high risk of deterioration into serious disease. And therefore, they are offered this antibody cocktail that has been approved by the FDA, by the Food and Drug Organization.
This is the one that President Trump took.
Exactly, exactly. Back in October, when it was really, really, really new. But it really appears that this antibody cocktail that mimics the effect of the reaction of the immunization, the human immunization system when it has antibodies, helps reduce the rate of hospitalization and death by 70%.
Wow.
So what's interesting is that it has to be taken again when the disease is still in an early stage of mild to moderate.
Meaning like you test and then you get Regeneron.
Exactly, exactly. Let's say you are, you know, in a 70-year-old patient with maybe some background diseases, so you are at high risk of turning into a serious patient, but you're still at home, you're feeling relatively well, your health fund here in Israel will come and offer you to take this antibody drug. A nurse and a doctor will come to your house to offer it to you, and so on and so forth. Now, what is the problem? The problem is that it appears that from preliminary data, not everyone is agreeing.
Everybody, meaning people that are vaccinated or unvaccinated?
Oh, so that's the thing. So people can be offered the drug even if they are vaccinated because they have other other risk factors. But the problem is that it appears that especially among the unvaccinated population, the rate of refusal to the drug is very high. And we know that most serious patients nowadays are unvaccinated in Israel. So again, we're talking about small numbers. It appears that health funds are a little hesitant to actually fully express the issue, maybe not for it to become too confrontational as the issue of vaccination is, but there might be a worrisome trend, because if unvaccinated patients who are already at risk to become serious patients, who are already crowding the hospitals, are also refusing a treatment that can prevent it, we might be in trouble.
It's very interesting. And you're going to be tracking that and trying to get us that data over time. So we'll have to check that out on jpost.com, because I think we'll want to know whether or not this is going to be a game changer for us, or this is really not going to have Absolutely. Enough impact.
Absolutely.
Crazy stuff. So, you know, one of the things that we want to do on this health and wellness podcast is also bring to light a little bit more about the Startup Nation. I mean, we are the Startup Nation in so many fields, but really over the course of COVID and before, we've done a lot in the biotech arena, in the research arena, to help find new drugs, new treatments, new protocols. And we wanted to be able to share some today. One of the things that we're going to do today is have a quick breakaway interview. We're going to do that now with Dr. Shahar Cohn, who runs the lab called Niacure, which is a lab or a company that is working on regenerative medicine. Specifically, think about, you know, an automobile, a car. When your car starts to get old, you take it into the shop, you say, oh, I need to replace the engine. So he has this vision that you will be able to place your organs exactly the same way.
We have with us today Dr. Shahar Cohn. He is the head of a company called Niacure. Thanks for being with us today, Shahar.
Thank you for having me.
For sure. So Niacure is focusing on what we call regenerative medicine. What is that?
Right. So regenerative medicine, that's an exciting branch of medicine that is about repairing, replacing, and even rejuvenating body parts, including cells, tissues, and organs. It is multidisciplinary and includes material science, engineering, biology, and of course, medicine. I mean, think about lizards that can regrow their entire limbs, or starfish that can regrow limbs and sometimes an entire body. Regenerative medicine is about how to translate these superpowers to humans. It's also about how to harness and enhance our own regenerative capacities that already exist in our body. So we use stem cells. These are undifferentiated cells that act like our body's building blocks, like our own built-in repair mechanism responsible to maintain and restore normal function, both on a day-to-day basis and also following an injury or a disease. It also relates to tissue engineering, something that is, that's applying engineering methodologies to biology in an attempt to repair or regrow an entire tissue and organ.
Amazing.
Nowadays, regenerative medicine is part of a bigger picture, the longevity revolution, and the understanding that aging is not necessarily something inevitable, but rather a disease with something that can and should be cured. It's the regenerative medicine industry is growing exponentially and dramatically changing medicine as we know it. I mean, imagine how treating a disease will look like in the future, where you could actually replace an organ with a brand new one.
So let's talk about that. You have a project called Organs on Demand. Explain mm-hmm. what that is and talk. I mean, it sounds to me when I hear organs on demand that it's like taking an organ off the shelf and having a transplant. Is that something you're thinking that we're going to be able to do?
Yes, exactly that. I mean, our goal is to actually solve the global shortage of organs that is available for transplantation. I mean, if you look at the numbers, it's truly a global crisis. I mean, in the U.S. alone, there are more than 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list. And every 10 minutes, someone is added to the list. And every day, on average, 20 people die while waiting for an organ. So these numbers actually underrepresent the true need, because countless more people in need of spare parts never make it to the waiting list. So undoubtedly, there is an urgent need for replaceable body parts. But with that in mind, what we do is we're using advanced tissue engineering techniques in order to develop human-compatible pig organs. These are organs that are immunologically acceptable and that in the future could be transplanted safely in humans. We believe that what we develop provides a significant shortcut in the effort to generate an unlimited supply of organs that will be available on demand.
It's absolutely stunning. I mean, now when is this happening? Is this a brave new world, or is this something where we can say, oh my gosh, the future is now?
Well, that's a good and an important question. My philosophy as a scientist is to look at complex biological problems through an engineering perspective. But when you do that, complex issues become solvable. So far, we've been able to show that our approach is technically feasible. I mean, we only do a slight, although significant, modification to a perfectly functioning organ to make it human compatible. So our next steps, they include functionality studies and then animal transplantation studies. We believe that within 3 to 5 years, we will be able to bring this technology to first human trials. So if you ask me, yeah, I mean, an unlimited supply of replaceable body parts, this is just around the corner.
Amazing. Well, first of all, I know we're going to be able to check in. We should let our readers know, also, and our listeners know that we have the Jerusalem Post conference next week on October 12th. They'll be able to tune in live and hear more about this. But mm-hmm. above and beyond that, I'm definitely going to check in with you in the next 3 to 5 years so that we mm-hmm. can find out if these organs are going to exist. Thanks so much, Shahar. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was fascinating. What did you think, Rosella?
Absolutely.
Amazing. So, Israel has also put out some research this week from Ben-Gurion University that I know you were looking at, and something that I'm not sure those of us who use a lot of artificial sweetener are going to want to know about, but tell us, Rosella, what that's about.
Oh, yeah. So, basically, scientists at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev had the idea of checking the effect of sweeteners on the body by just checking a group of athletes who, because of their diet, eat and drink a lot of different food and beverages that contain this kind of sweeteners, saccharin, dextrose, all sorts of like common sweeteners. And what they found is that there are some problems in the fact that a lot of artificial sweeteners interfere with bacterial communication. So the findings of this research by Professor Ariel Kushmaru and Dr. Karina Goldberg were just published in the Journal of International Molecular Sciences. And what they found is that, again, they don't erase the bacteria, but they do cause problems for in bacterial communication, which eventually can cause digestive problem and other uneasiness with our tummy, basically. So when we think that maybe instead of, you know, a normal, regular beverage with sugar, we want to get a Diet Coke, maybe we will have to think twice.
So now we're realizing that Diet Coke not only is qualified to clean our toilets, but it also has sweetener that is probably going to make us sick to our stomach.
Basically, yes.
Fascinating. Well, for those of us who are watching our weight, I guess that we should think about whether or not we should just be eating fruits and vegetables and not be having Diet Coke, is what it sounds like. Is that a fair assessment?
Again, it's like always a good question. Like the professors, experts have been debating the health, the long-term benefits of these sweeteners in all sorts of ways, the way they curb the appetite or not, the way they affect our weight in different ways compared to just, you know, not giving us the calories. And so it seems that ultimately digestive issues can be affected by assuming a lot of these sweeteners. Again, like maybe in an ideal diet, sweeteners should be reduced, at least dramatically reduced.
So interesting. You know, I remember more than 20 years ago, not to date myself completely, but when I was in college and going to Washington University in St. Louis, which was near the Monsanto plant there, and there was research that had been found about NutraSweet causing brain tumors. That was 20 years ago. We continue to have these things on the market. And, you know, I guess the lesson that we often, you know, learn is that we need real food, right? Chemicals aren't good for us.
And yeah, and ultimately what the scientists are saying is that at least food should be labeled better so that when we eat, when we choose to eat something, we at least know not only that a certain substance is inside the food or the beverage, but also how much, and therefore we can make a more aware choice.
It's interesting because if you remember about when did it start, maybe a year or two ago in Israel, we started labeling our foods with high sugar, high salt, high fat. There are little stickers on all of the products in Israel that tell you whether or not really the product is good for you. Does that deter you at all from buying food?
I think in general it doesn't, but I have to say that I have been very surprised to find out the certain like food that I just consider, you know, like let's say a certain kind of cheese, I'm Italian, mozzarella, you know, it's like, okay, you know, obviously it has whatever nutrients it has, and then all of a sudden I see this red sticker on it and I'm like, wait, what?
Right, high in salt on cheese. I get that one also.
Exactly. So I think it's awareness is always good, and then we can take it from there.
So, you know, lastly, I think one of the things that we were hoping to do today, and I think you'll stick with us, hopefully, our listeners, and iterate with us as we move this podcast along and bring you more information and more news from the health and wellness section of our world. But we wanted to be able to offer some health tips to you. Now we have this new section on jpost.com where you can click and you can find out nutrition information, pregnancy, birth, parenting information, aging, all these kinds of things. And they're really interesting pieces. And one of the ones, speaking of food, that we thought we would highlight today were, as we get closer to the winter and, you know, we're huddling inside, thinking about what five high-protein snacks you can eat when you are busy. Mm-hmm. So want to go through that list with you. Number one is
a handful of nuts.
That's right. Combining a variety of nuts and seeds in salads, cooked dishes, smoothies, cereals, soups, pastas, it's convenient and it adds a lot of protein.
And it's not a processed food. Hopefully.
Hopefully, right? Never know anymore. Number two is
edamame, which I really love.
Yes. How do you cook your edamame?
Very simple. Boil them, lots of salt, and that's it. But what's interesting is when they first came out, I remember that I would just go to, you know, a sushi restaurant and order soybeans, and all the people were eating with me would drive them nuts, and they say, "Can't you just order edamame?" And I was like, "What's edamame?" It's like, soybeans.
So funny. That's right. But soybeans, you know, that are stored inside those little green pods, and they're fun to eat. My kids love to eat them. They're low in calories, high in protein, and that natural packaging that they come into makes it sort of feel like the seed. It's fun. Okay, number three.
Oh, wow, pumpkin seeds.
So it says in our article that 100 grams of pumpkin seeds has about 20 grams of protein, which means that about 30 grams, just a handful, contains between 6 and 7 grams of protein.
Yogurt?
Without artificial sweetener, and that is something you have to check.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can put some fruit in it. I don't know if our article recommends it, but, you know, fresh cut fruit that, you know, peel and add is always a good addition.
That's a great sweetener for sure. And eating yogurt, of course, also, and we can talk about that in a different podcast, but eating yogurt is also gives you a lot of positive probiotic bacteria.
Absolutely.
Which is good for your gut. Okay, next in line.
Last but not least, legume pasta chips.
Wow. Wow, that's fun. Though that says that if you're familiar with this pasta chip craze, what it is, just to explain to you, is it's quite simply cooked pasta that's mixed with basic spices, transferred to reheating into your home oven, and next thing you know, you've got a chip that is actually much healthier, right? And delicious, but not like a potato chip that's a fried potato taken out of a fryer.
Absolutely.
So that's healthy for you, and it's higher in protein. You can mix that regular pasta instead of using regular pasta. I'm sorry, you can make these again with legumes, lentils, or peas, and that is what adds the protein.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, it has been so much fun doing this, actually.
Yes, it really was.
So this is the end of our Health and Wellness podcast this week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
For sure. We'll check back soon.
Bye.